know, this talk maybe should have been entitled Providing the Pieces for a Practical Approach, because I certainly don't want you all to think that I've got the answer. So what I'm going to do is to provide a palette, if you will, to have a discussion about some of the factors that impact, I think, STD prevention. Some of my comments will be repetitive. Again, you get pediatricians who love adolescents together, and we kind of do the same mantra. But these are some of the areas that I'll talk about. One thing that I want to point out is that we seem to be going in the wrong direction, and I certainly don't mean to point a finger at any one person, although I could, and you all probably know who I'm talking about. But in addition to our HIV numbers increasing, for the first time since HIV surveillance began, for chlamydia surveillance, we've seen over a million, for the first time we hit over a million cases of chlamydia, a 5.6% increase from 2005. And for those of you who know the data, when you take everybody who's ever had sex and look at categories, 15 to 19 year old females have the highest prevalence of chlamydia infections. So these are the people that we're talking about today. Also notable is that the teen birth rate showed its first increase since 1991. There was a 3% increase among 15 to 19 year olds, a 4% increase among 18 to 19 year olds. And I think that whenever we're thinking about interventions, we have to take into account that the landscape of the adolescents that we're serving in this country is changing. That, you know, our cultural competency requires us to not just think of, you know, single ethnic populations, that we have a lot of immigrants, and therefore the way that they may perceive information about sexuality education, the way that their parents may respond to our wanting to provide this information can be very, very different. And then approximately 50% of all STIs in the United States occur in 15 to 24 year olds. Now, we take care of a fair number of HIV positive adolescents. We have probably about 200 in care now. And actually, most of the data that you'll get on HIV, the surveillance data, is only taken from 35 to 37 states and territories who have been reporting about HIV for a very long time. So now, again, not mentioning any names, that, you know, we've moved to mandated reporting of names so that we can make sure that we're not double dipping, so we really get the amount of money we're supposed to. Since so much money is going to abstinence-only education, there's not enough to give to other areas. This number is expected that it may be in the 50 to 60,000 range instead of the 40 to 45,000 range. And 13.8% of these infections, at least from 2005 data, are occurring in young people between the ages of 15 to 24. Behavioral risk, sexual activity, unprotected sexual activity, number one cause in adolescents, all right? We don't see the IV drug use. They're using condoms inconsistently, they have older age partners, and then they're negotiating the maze of a lack of education, as Abigail mentioned too, the myth of invulnerability, it'll happen to everybody else but not me, the lack of confidential, affordable health care, and most importantly, adolescent-friendly health care. And I think it's incumbent upon us who work with adolescents to realize that adolescents can be very unforgiving people. When their first encounter with a provider is not nice, when there's, you know, I know people who, you know, they're taking the heads exam and it's like, well, you don't have sex, do you? Oh, yeah. You know, and they're writing all the time. Oh, well, you've never drank, have you? You don't look like you drink. Oh, yeah, okay, that's what I thought. Then, you know, adolescents may perceive, oh, this is the way everybody's going to be. I can't really have a candid conversation. Nobody's going to bring this information to me. And it may preclude them from taking the next step in terms of seeking maybe another source of care. So we need to be very careful about the way we interact with them. I also need to bring up the issue of fear of disclosure, not only in the context of just sitting down with you and as the provider saying, okay, well, gosh, you know, I've been doing this and that, and I, you know, really don't know how to talk about this. But in the HIV world, we know that men who have sex with men are, you know, at the top in terms of risk exposures. And, you know, if you assume, you know, you're sitting down and you're taking the history and, you know, you're talking to a guy and you're like, oh, well, tell me about your girlfriend, you know, assuming heterosexuality, or with a girl, tell me about your boyfriend, then they're going to close down, they're not going to talk to you, and you lose the opportunity to avail yourself, your knowledge, to give them so that they can perhaps protect themselves better. You probably have seen this data, but I think it's interesting that here we are, that 13.8% of new HIV infections are in this 15 to 24 year age group, but when we look at high school students, only 11.9% were ever tested for HIV infection. With the new CDC recommendation for routinized testing, hopefully these numbers will be significantly increased, if not with the 2007 Youth Risk Behavior Survey data, but maybe 2009. But you can see from this that we have a very long way to go. Especially in context of high school students who are currently sexually active. So these were students who had had sex within the 3 months preceding the survey. Now overall, about half, it's 46.8% of adolescents in high school say that they have ever had sexual activity. And again, when you look at male to female and ethnicity breakdowns, you know, we need to focus. And although a lot more young people are using condoms, we still have, you know, 35-38% that are not. So certainly, although the message may be getting there, you know, we need to improve upon the message. So I want to focus now with this palette, just giving a little bit of data on how mental health, substance abuse issues, and early pubertal onset, which was alluded to by Dr. Dahl, can play into this palette. High school students who drank alcohol or used drugs before last intercourse, a little less than a quarter, more males than females. And in this situation, more Hispanics and whites versus African Americans. And current alcohol use, again, is a little bit higher. So kids are engaging in a variety of high-risk behaviors, often in sort of a tapestry where, you know, there's several things going on at once. And so our conversation can't just be about STDs. It also needs to be about a variety of things that may also be going on in terms of high-risk behaviors, in addition to some either primary or secondary reasons in the mental health area or substance abuse area that could be leading them to maybe engage in unsafe sexual practices. So I think that this is just, it makes me sad that, you know, you look at that more than a quarter of young people reported every day for more than or equal to 2 weeks in a row that they stopped doing some usual activity because they felt sad or hopeless. Well, we know the depression, we know the hopelessness, we know that a history of abuse, either verbal, physical, or sexual, can lead to high-risk behaviors. And one of the behaviors that we may see is somewhat reckless sexual activity, perhaps that can put one in harm's way for STDs. The situation was presented about early pubertal onset, and if you think about it, if you're African American, it's mostly been seen this downtrend in African American and Hispanic females, and a lot of it has been thought to be secondary to body weight, that, you know, if you're heavier, you may tend to undergo puberty a little bit earlier. But if you can imagine 2 to 2.5 years from the time that you start puberty, that a female is usually menarchal, that we now have somebody in the fourth grade who looks like an adult, who we know doesn't have the circuitry to, you know, participate in adult behaviors, but who's going to be perceived by the people walking down the street as perhaps being older than he or she really is, and therefore being approached in that way and not having a clue of how to deal with this. And if we, you know, think about this new research on brain development, we're now talking about, you know, 12 to, you know, 14 years from the time that this person is capable of procreation till the time that all of this pruning has taken place and this myelinization has taken place. So we have this huge window where we can't, you know, just take sexuality information and put it in high school and say, well, this is when they need it. In this situation, we need to go before middle school. And I don't know how you all work, but, you know, if I give a talk to sixth or seventh graders, I can't do condom demonstrations. I can't even show a condom. Suddenly in eighth grade, in some schools I'm allowed, and then in high school I can kind of do whatever I want, but I probably missed the boat from a lot of those kids because I wasn't allowed to speak frankly about sexuality. And I try and remind people that, you know, you're sexual from the day, probably before you enter the world, because in the womb, you know, you can see babies masturbating, and you know, when they come out, if they count the fingers and the toes first, the next thing they do is look in between the legs, well, is it a boy or a girl? They might look that first before they count. So, you know, I think, you know, people need to realize that we're sexual beings. And these are some of the other topics that I wanted to issue, just raise, just in terms of some of the issues that adolescents bring to us. I'm invincible. And oftentimes something has to happen, and we hope it's not HIV, we hope it's not a motor vehicle accident that either culminates in death or, you know, somebody being in a rehab institute for years and years and years. You know, sometimes a little bit of chlamydia or gonorrhea is not bad because, you know, it's something you can treat, you can give them, it gives you an opportunity to be able to talk to them about how they feel about that, what they may do the next time to prevent this from going. I don't know where to go. We hear a lot. Our clinic actually provides services in the evening, so our clinic is open from 1 to 6. So the kids can come after school, they don't have to miss school, and we're not competing with that interest. I don't know how to talk to my partner. You know, it's really interesting. They're having sex, and then you're sitting with them talking about this, and they're hiding their faces and, you know, turning all shades of colors. You know, they're so embarrassed about it. And it's like, well, you know, tell me about your partner. Oh, well, his name is such and such, or her name is such and such. Well, what else do you know about them? Well, you know, if you go down to that McDonald's on, you know, 14th and make a right, you know, their house is right there. But don't know middle name, you know, don't know birth date, may know sign, but no, not the birth date. So, you know, we have to teach them how to communicate better with their partners. I read that condoms don't really protect you. You know, for a while we had kids cutting holes in condoms, and they'd be, well, like, Dr. Henry, I wore it, but I just wanted to increase the sensation. And so again, you know, factual information becomes very, very important. And always ask them what they think they know, because it will enlighten you and also help you to provide the more appropriate factual information. I'm not sexually active, which means that I'm promiscuous. I'm just having sex. So serial monogamy has, you know, similar risks if you're not protecting yourself. So, again, we need to take that to account. I just don't want my parents to know. We know that parent talk works. And one of the things that we've done as a part of our outreach efforts, I'll discuss in a moment, but has to do with parents. And we need to empower parents, because a lot of times, you know, the kid will come in and the parent will say, well, you take him or you take her, because I don't know what to say. And it's like, well, why don't you sit in on the conversation? Because this needs to be an ongoing dialogue. This is not a one-stop shop. We need to, you know, I'll give you the facts today, but you can use this information, you know, on and on. My daughter, Desperate Housewives, when it first came out, I'm like, well, you can't watch Desperate Housewives without me. So for the first year and a half, we watched Desperate Housewives together. And so there's things that parents can do that they may not realize, where they can point out things about relationships, point out issues about sexuality, you know, appropriate behavior that, you know, can be fun. I like Desperate Housewives. But my friends say it's okay. And one of the things that we know is the value of peers. That, you know, if you're in a peer group where, you know, they say, well, gosh, no, I'm not smoking, I'm not drinking, I'm not having sex, you're more likely to perhaps, you know, be protected versus a peer group where everybody's doing it and maybe that adolescent isn't doing it, but may be drawn in order to fit. Or I wanted the benefits, which is something that, you know, I'm hearing more and more about, especially among young women who want the new gym shoes, who want things that their families can't afford to give them and are engaging in sex, often with much older partners, to be able to get these things. And, you know, the mumps story is still alive and well. Oh, we don't need a condom. I had mumps when I was a kid and I'm infertile, so, you know, I can't get you pregnant. But, you know, they forget about the STDs. So the parts of the brain that youth need most to develop good judgment and decision-making, as we hear, develops last. And I think that one of the things that we need to always do is to employ the mantra, educate and remediate. I always say that adolescent medicine providers, I think, would make the best politicians because we're spin doctors. I can talk about sex 365 ways. And I need to learn how to do that because up to the 112th way, they might not have heard me. And then finally at 116, they like, oh, I got it. Now, maybe it was because they had just kept hearing it for so long. They were like, just make her shut up, you know, so I'm just gonna say I got it. But maybe I finally said the right thing that clued them in and said, okay, good. And we also need to focus more on males. I think we really need to bring males in the mix. A lot of what we do is focused on females, and you know, in a heterosexual relationship, it takes two, and that person is a male. And in male-to-male relationships, that person is a male. So some of our strategies have been bringing STI and HIV information and testing into the community. And this was the brainchild of one of my colleagues in the division who said, you know what, we're not getting kids to come in, we need to go out. So we interviewed our HIV positive youth and said, would you be willing to host an intervention at your house? You know, we're gonna do HIV, STI 101 education. We do a condom demonstration. Often we would bring one of our HIV positive youth to talk. And we would bring a health educator so that we could do like an individualized risk assessment at the conclusion of that, you know, 1 hour presentation. And then kids were given the opportunity to test. And we still use the OraSure, although we're moving to OraQuick. And we've done over 300 of these over the last couple of years. There was one that I was at where, you know, some people decided that they were going to argue down the street and shots rang out. Everybody hit the floor, so I hit the floor too. And then they were like, okay, we can continue. So we were on the floor for about 5 minutes and we kept going. But one of the things that we've been able to do is some of those kids who we've reached through that venue have actually come into the clinic for care. And, you know, her whole thing was if we go out, then maybe they'll come in. And we have seen some of that give and take. As a part of this, we were targeting, you know, housing projects, places of high risk based on some of the data that we get from the city. And there was this one woman who hosted one and then actually hosted a second one. And so the idea came, well, why don't we start a parent health educator network? And so now one of the things that we're doing is educating parents to be health educators and to get other parents. Because, you know, I can go into the, you know, projects and they'll say, yeah, and who are you? It's much easier for someone who's part of that community to reach out and get people to participate in an activity. We're also targeting one community in Chicago, the North and South Lawndale areas. We have a speakers bureau, and this is actually funded, so the speakers get a stipend, but you know, we hope that the speakers will continue to go after this funding is gone, but we want to develop a relationship with some of the middle schools and the high schools in this area that has very high risk of STD and HIV, and have the schools get to know us so that they look to us for a resource and become comfortable with us so that, you know, we can continue to perhaps ramp up the services that we can provide. And I can't tell you the importance of role playing when you're working with adolescents. And, you know, I've named some of my role plays Miller Time. You know, Miller Time is okay, you're out drunk and, you know, or you're on drugs and, you know, you may be in a situation where you might have to have, where, you know, you might have sex, what do you do? And if you have one of those chairs in your office, those chairs where you can spin them around, you spin the adolescent around, you know, for a few minutes, and you've got the penis model on the table, and you give them a condom, and trying to watch them put on, oh man, it's hilarious. And, you know, so it's a concrete way of explaining to them, this is how you'll feel. When you're drunk, this is how you're going to be out of sorts. You remember that you had the condom because I handed it to you. Home alone, you know, if you choose to be at your, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend's house by yourself, guess what? Things are going to happen. So you want to avoid that situation. Parent trap. And then in terms of team approach, we work with psychologists and each adolescent who comes in gets a medical doctor as well as a mental health provider. We also have peer health educators in our HIV program. We have HIV positive youth who are peer buddies, because sometimes when they come in for their first visit, they don't want to talk to us at all. You know, they just want to talk to somebody who's been there, done that, looks like them. And so, you know, we afford them that. And we encourage frequent visits. And I work at the county health department, so it may be a little bit easier for me to do that, because nobody's saying, okay, well, Lisa, you got to see people every 15 minutes. But STI prevention has to focus on all adolescents. I think that we miss the boat if we only target high-risk groups and fail to look at everybody in terms of delivering this model. And that we have to understand adolescent culture. You know, adult models aren't portable to young people. And sometimes the people, you know, my people that I work with, the administration doesn't get that. That, you know, no, one model doesn't fit all. My population is unique and you have to allow me the autonomy and the creativity to develop programs that I know are going to work for them. Abstinence only, you know, as Abigail mentioned, the virginity pledges. In fact, I thought it was interesting if you all read the Mathematica study, which evaluated several of the programs, and this was in elementary and middle school kids, and there were four programs that they evaluated, but the average age, the median age for the onset of sexual activity in the United States is supposedly around 16.7, 17 years. Well, in this group, the abstinence-only group, of those kids who became sexually active, the age was 14.9. So you tell me who needs to be out of Washington. And small changes in behavior can make a difference. If we can just get somebody who hadn't even thought about a condom to move from pre-contemplation to contemplating using a condom, we've made a stride in the right direction. So in the climb to safer sexual activity, these are some of the things that we need to think about. You know, as Abigail mentioned, we need policies. And of course, if our legislators aren't willing to make adolescence a priority and to put our youth, our future, at the forefront, then we're never going to get to the top of this. I keep saying that with HIV, we focused on women, pregnant women. It was a Pavlovian response. You saw a pregnant woman, you did an HIV test. Now we're looking at less than 100 babies being born in the United States. The next natural step in HIV prevention is adolescence. So if we were focused the same resources on this population, then we're gonna prevent these young people from moving into adulthood with HIV. They're not gonna get HIV. So let's state teens are important and stamp out STIs. Thank you.
Hello. We want to take about 2 or 3 minutes and take just a couple of questions. If anyone has any burning questions for our panelists this afternoon. Yes, right here.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Henry. That was a really interesting presentation. I had a question specifically about the occasions where you go into the homes of children or those of a parent educator and screen the kids with HIV, I assume chlamydia and gonorrhea. You said you'd done about 300 such either events or screenings. I wasn't sure which it was, children or screening events. And I wondered what amount of disease you had detected and also how you handled the confidentiality issues, given that you're in the home and the parents presumably know the children are screened, and do you have any problems with them trying to ascertain what the findings were?
In terms of the number, and we call this the friend-to-friend network, we've probably done about 40 or 50 with parents, the majority with youth. And the parents are usually present at these. And sometimes at one that I performed, there were 8 parents there who were listening in on the information as we were providing them to the young people. And we have identified 6 HIV positive youth from these activities. Now, you know, the math is usually you need to test 1,000 to get one. So we're probably about in that ballpark. We usually ask that there be at least 6 youth there, a maximum of 10.
I had a question for Ms. English about the Center for Adolescent Health and Law. So you pointed out the importance of adding prevention to minor consent laws. And I know in California, we currently do not include the word prevention in our minor consent law, which only authorizes minors to consent for diagnosis and treatment. So I was curious if you had done any mapping across the United States that had been helpful with our efforts to expand laws that authorize expedited partner therapy. So if there was a mapping project you had done to look at states had minor consent laws that included prevention, states that were considering it, and states that already had it, and if also you plan to do any partnerships with CDC to try to expand that effort, as I think at least in California, that would be a critical policy piece.
Well, I think it's a very interesting question as to, you know, even why it is that there's a small handful of states that in their STD and reportable disease laws include the word prevention along with diagnosis and treatment. At the Center for Adolescent Health and the Law, we have done a review, and we have a monograph of state laws that we did a few years ago, and we're actually going to issue an updated version of that monograph this year, but it tracks all of the state minor consent laws based on status and based on services in all of the states. We have been looking at whether there are ways in which even the existing laws that do not include the word prevention might be interpreted or used in such a way as to encompass some of the prevention issues, and that we're engaged in that right now. We have a couple of projects going on doing that kind of an analysis, but we'd be delighted to talk with people in the CDC or in different states about those issues. I think that before an attempt is made in any one state to change laws, it requires a very careful analysis of whether the effort would result in something positive or something negative, because sometimes you open a Pandora's box and sometimes you actually can be successful. So I think that requires careful analysis.
Yes.
Hi, this question is for Dr. Henry Reed. And you spoke to difficulties with condom demonstrations and sex education in elementary school or grades lower than sixth grade. And I'm just wondering, what grade or age do you recommend sex education to begin, and what difficulties and disadvantages do you see in elementary school sex education?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. What grade should we start doing this?
Yeah, what age do you think is appropriate to balance
for sex ed?
Yeah.
I'd say first grade. I mean, I think it needs to begin early, and we need to build on it. And if you look at, you know, the Scandinavian countries that have teens' sexual activity rates as high as ours, but teen pregnancy rates that are significantly lower than ours, it's because they view sexuality as something that's natural and normal. And that if you're going to engage in sexual activity, you need to do so with maturity and responsibility. You know, our system, you know, is schizophrenic. You know, you see the raps and, you know, the media and all the stuff on the internet, but then we've got people saying, all right, well, it's abstinence only until marriage, which already has, you know, kicked out people who are gay identified, because, you know, that's not going to matter to them. I really do think that middle school going into high school for, you know, more intensive discussions about this is the way to go. Right now, we start a lot of this stuff in high school, and like I said, we've missed the boat. I mean, oral sex is, you know, the thing with middle school students. And although you can't get pregnant with that, you certainly can get any of a variety of STDs. So I would say we start early. I'd say first grade. I'll never get elected president.
We'd like to thank you all for your time and attention this afternoon. The speakers will be up front if you have additional questions. Thank you, and have a nice rest of the conference.